one of the things that proponents of trade liberalization will often complain about is that, you know, trade is, by all accounts, probably responsible for no more than, say, a quarter of the manufacturing job loss that's occurred over the decades. Most of that is probably due to automation. But trade is something that folks can see. They see the president give a speech in the Oval Office talking about a trade deal. They hear their congressman debating, should they vote for this trade deal or vote against this trade deal? It's a matter of public discussion and debate and choice.
You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hi, everybody. Happy New Year. And welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of eastern Iowa and northwestern Illinois. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and as our listeners know, one of the major themes of this show since its beginning has been the topic of globalization and its impact on our region. There are those who feel our region in the Midwest has been more impacted by globalization than any other for a variety of reasons. We've looked at the economic impacts of globalization. We've certainly looked at the political impacts of globalization. And that's why I'm very pleased to have a guest as my guest today, an author of a new book that folks should really take some time and read, because it kind of gives a history of this phenomenon, what it's happened, its positives, its negatives, and kind of where we go from here. So it's a very important book. And again, for our region, which has been hit by this, by this globalization more than others, I think it's a very timely and important book. It's called The World's Worst Bet, How the Globalization Gamble Went Wrong, and What Would Make It Right. And the author's with me today, David J. Lynch. David is the global economics correspondent for The Washington Post. David, thank you so much for taking the time today.
Well, I'm happy to be here.
Well, our area, I'm familiar with it. I live near Galesburg, Illinois, which has witnessed a Maytag refrigerator plant move to Mexico back in the early 2000s. We've got right now a CNH facility in Burlington, Iowa, announced it's moving and shutting down. So this is still with us. But let's kind of step back and we've always been involved in global trade in our country since the very beginning. But when would you say this recent phenomenon of globalization really began? And you mentioned in the beginning the attractive theory behind it. Kind of start off with both of those, if you would, please.
Sure. Well, the period that I look at in the world's worst bet is the last 30 years or so, which some economists have described as the era of hyper globalization, when, as you rightly point out, a phenomenon that we've dealt with for decades really went into overdrive with the end of the Cold War. And at the time, and I would say I was part of this sort of happy or optimistic consensus. If you think back to those years, you know, late 1989, the Berlin Wall comes down. For those of us who grew up with the Cold War, a really extraordinary development that I'll confess I never thought I would live to see. And then a couple of years later, the Soviet Union itself disappears on Christmas Day in 1991. And democracy and free markets are really spreading across the globe, it seems, at the time. And economic or American policymakers of that era, saw it as a phenomenon, globalization, that would deliver sort of a double-barreled win for Americans. We'd get widespread shared prosperity here at home, and we'd get peace abroad as countries like China and Russia would open up their political systems under the influence of expanded trade and would sort of, if not enthusiastically, willingly join a U.S.-led international order. And if you fast forward to today, of course, that's not the world we've ended up in. And so what I wanted to do with the book was try to figure out what the hell happened. How did we get from those happy, almost triumphalist moments of the 1990s to the era of economic nationalism and populism and the return of geopolitical conflict that we see today.
There's one event that kind of explored both sides of this. It was that famous debate between Al Gore and Ross Perot. And for our listeners, some may be too young to remember, this was a debate that took place on, I believe, CNN. But Ross Perot, of course, was against NAFTA. Al Gore, Vice President Gore, was in favor. And most observers felt Gore won the debate. But I remember Ross Perot's famous line of that great sucking sound of all the jobs and investment going south. That may not have happened to the degree that he described, but it certainly did. And there was some pain involved. It just seems like globalization's benefits, David, as you point out, have been very widespread. And we can talk about that. I want to talk about that a little bit. But the pain has really been targeted in certain areas, and our area is one of them.
Absolutely. I think of the benefits from globalization, and those have been enormous. And we should take a second to talk about that, because I don't want people to get the idea that this is an anti-globalization book, or that I think that somehow you can turn back the clock. You can't. The benefits of globalization have been spread across the entire economy, the entire U.S. economy, like frosting on a cake. We've all benefited from the availability of low-cost products from China that helped keep inflation under control for 10 or 15 years before the pandemic disrupted everything. A better mix of jobs in the economy, though not more jobs. And so those benefits have been at the aggregate level, and that's what the folks that I think of as sort of the traditional exponents or supporters of globalization, they tend to focus on that globalization's made us better off, made the country richer, fueled economic growth. So how can you be against it? But the problem is, and this should have been foreseeable because it's what classic trade theory would tell you, is that the benefits have been widely distributed, but the costs have been concentrated, and they've been concentrated in specific cohorts or groups of people, those with the fewest skills, the most basic manufacturing skills, the least amount of education, often no more than a high school diploma. And those are millions and millions of Americans, and they're the ones who bore the costs. Particularly when they were concentrated in manufacturing dependent communities across the midsection of the country, down into the southeast as well. And those costs were always given short shrift by policymakers, I think.
Yeah, it's, I guess you could call it the consumer society, consumer economy we've become. We love our flat screen TVs that are imported that are cheaper than would have been made perhaps here. We've all benefited from that. There's no question. There were plans afoot early on, and you have just a fascinating discussion with former President Clinton at the end that I want to talk about too. But the plan was at the beginning was to help address those that were going to be hurt by globalization. In other words, the proponents saw this to some degree, and they had some ideas on what to do. Could you talk about that a little and what happened to that?
And I think of Bill Clinton as sort of the godfather of U.S. style globalization, because I don't think any American politician before or since has really understood so thoroughly the economic landscape and been able to articulate so persuasively how Americans should be prepared for the change that's coming, because change is always coming. That's a constant of life. We all know it from our individual lives, and certainly at the national level. You can never freeze the economy in amber and say, okay, we've got it perfect. Nobody loses a job from this moment forward, and we'll all just be great. That's not possible. And Clinton used to say, globalization's a fact. It's not a policy choice. The issue is how we respond to it. And that's what I discuss in the book. What I describe as the globalization gamble that went wrong is the implicit bet that our leaders made in the 1990s, that we could enjoy all these benefits of globalization without worrying too much about the costs. Although people like Clinton did say that there would be winners and losers, these distributional costs that I referred to earlier, but that would be okay because the winners would gain so much, college-educated folks on the coasts in particular, that some of their gains could be devoted to helping the quote-unquote losers with what they would need to position themselves to benefit from new opportunities that would be created by this new globalized economy. And the problem is that part never happened. The winners made their gains. Globalization was great for guys like me, but the gains were never really apportioned in a fair way so that somebody working in a tire plant in northwestern Tennessee, for instance, which is one story I tell in the book, could get the help that they would need, retraining, income support, maybe relocation assistance, whatever it might be, place-based strategies to try and revive their community as it suffered losses because of imports. That there was always something else that at the national level we chose to prioritize. In the late 90s, it was balancing the budget. In the early 2000s, understandably, it was a war on terror, and then two wars in Iraq and Afghanistan that grew out of that. Sometimes it was a desire to keep a rising China on side, have good relations with China. But what always got the short end of the stick was the disadvantaged factory worker who was struggling to find his or her footing in this new globalized economy.
And there was this condescending tone, and I remember it, basically telling people that lost their jobs, move to where the jobs are, or go get a college education. And there, I could feel that resentment building out here. And when I remember hearing Donald Trump in 2015 at a rally on satellite radio, I heard him talking about this and the language he used, saying, "We need to bring back manufacturing here." I'm thinking, wow, my dad, who was a union president, and he was deceased, but he would be saying he's right on. And I kind of had a feeling that that message was going to resonate, and we never knew how well that would resonate in the next three presidential races.
Yeah, it was. I remember that same sort of condescension, and again, I'll confess, I claim no clairvoyance in my understanding of these issues at the time. I'm sure I probably would have said some of the same things that the strongest proponents of globalization were saying, which would boil down to, well, nobody wants those jobs anyway. The jobs were losing. Nobody wants their kid to work in a coal mine, or nobody wants their kid to work in a textile factory. Nobody wants these jobs. And if you're the head of a think tank in Washington, D.C., or you're a college-educated policymaker, or someone for whom time off from work is a sabbatical in between university appointments, or a sabbatical in between finishing one job and starting another. If you've never known what it's like to be involuntarily without work, it's easy to sort of take for granted the notion that there's always another job around. You just need to go find it. And I do think there was a failure to really have enough empathy in our economic policy making. I know that probably sounds like a soft consideration, and you're never going to have an economy, and I think we all know this implicitly. You're never going to have an economy or an economic system that's going to make 100% of the people happy and fulfilled 100% of the time. You need the sort of creative destruction that, the buggy whip manufacturer goes away as the horseless carriage or the automobile comes on the scene. Nobody wants to stop technology. The creation of the iPhone spanned all sorts of jobs with app. Nobody in the late 1990s, nobody knew what an app designer was. That job didn't exist. There are lots of guys making a good living today designing apps and video games and all sorts of things. So we always have to be open to what's coming next. But the issue is, people do need some help from government preparing for and coping with change that results from policy decisions taken in Washington. And one of the things that proponents of trade liberalization will often complain about is that, trade is, by all accounts, probably responsible for no more than, say, a quarter of the manufacturing job loss that's occurred over the decades. Most of that is probably due to automation. But trade is something that folks can see. They see the president give a speech in the Oval Office talking about a trade deal. They hear their congressman debating should they vote for this trade deal or vote against this trade deal. It's a matter of public discussion and debate and choice. Whereas, if Caterpillar is going to introduce some new machinery on the line, or if General Electric's going to automate a plant, nobody gets to vote on that. That just happens, and so it's not as visible. It's not a matter of debate and choice and discussion publicly. And so trade probably does get outsized consideration or blame for some of these phenomena. But that being the case, I think it's incumbent upon supporters of trade liberalization to acknowledge the downside and to be prepared to support these other domestic policies that might mitigate it and help folks adjust and cope.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and my guest today as we kick off the new year, 2026, is David Lynch. He's the global economics correspondent for the Washington Post, and he just wrote what I consider to be a very, very important book on a topic that's of great interest to us here in the Midwest, especially in our region in particular. It's called The World's Worst Bet: How the Globalization Gamble Went Wrong. And then in parentheses, and what would make it right? We've been talking a little bit about the background of this globalization trend, hyperglobalization, when it began, and how its impact on communities, on our country, some of the positive aspects, and some of the more negative ones, which our region is very familiar with. But we're also, in fairness, on the agricultural side, globalization opened up enormous markets for farmers. So it's a mixed bag, and this book does a great job of being even-handed and looking at both sides of it. I'm just curious, and again, David, I mean, we've seen here locally the impact of globalization. You talk about it in general terms, but we've seen it here locally, the impact on people, on families, and on communities, devastating impacts, what's happened. Are there examples from around the globe, and I know you talk about it in your book some, what can be done? I mean, instead of just saying, here, go get a college degree, the retraining programs are kind of very mixed, I would say, in their effectiveness. There's some ideas out there on what a better approach would be.
Yeah, there are, and I should say, my takeaway from what I've looked at and found in researching the book is there's no silver bullet to any of this stuff, and part of where I think we've gone wrong in recent years is politicians from both parties. You referred to President Trump earlier, but the Biden administration did a fair bit of this as well, and it's an article of faith on politicians on both sides is promising the return of manufacturing jobs. That is, I don't know many serious economists who think that bringing back large numbers of manufacturing jobs is possible. If you put trade aside for a moment, we've seen a reduction of manufacturing employment as a percentage of the total in every advanced economy on the planet. It's happened in Germany, it's happened in Canada, it's happened in the United States, it's happening now in China. Just as we saw earlier, that same sort of process happened on the farm. Right? If you go back to 1900, most Americans worked on the farm, and it took pretty much all of us working all the time to grow the food we needed to sustain ourselves. And then, thanks to factory, not factory, agriculture, farm automation, automated combines and tractors and whatnot, well, then we didn't need as many people. And so those people were freed up to leave the farm, and they went into the cities and worked by and large in factories. And in the 1950s, something like one out of every three Americans was working in a farm. Sorry, working in a factory. So one out of three Americans in a factory in the 1950s. Today, it's about 8% of the total. And to reverse that, is really flying against the wind. You can, if you wanted to spend unlimited amounts of money and put up unrestricted levels of tariffs, you could have some effect at the margin, but you're not going to bring back the 5 million jobs that have disappeared over the last 20 years. And so, to my mind, part of what we need to do is get more realistic about where most Americans work, where the good jobs of the future are, and we have to take steps to prepare people, educate them, train them, and whatnot. Now, you asked specifically, are there examples of places to look to? One country that does a very good job, and it's a small country, is Denmark. But they have a much more active program. They do spend more as well, and I talk in the book toward the end about how we might close that circle. But Denmark has a much more active program. Our retraining efforts have been, as you suggested, sort of hit and miss, and often it's because there's a lot of checking the box. You get laid off, you get into this program, okay, you sign up, you meet with a counselor once, they hand you a list of things, or you go in a classroom for some period of time. Maybe the classes are full for 6 months, and so you got to sit around. So there's a lot of shortcomings with it. Denmark has a much more active program where you're assigned an individual counselor, trainer, advisor, what have you, and they stay on you. You are their project, and they have much better outcomes in part as a result. They also spend more, as I said, and these efforts are not going to be free. Nobody or few people want to or would support sort of adopting a European economic system here. A lot of what makes the United States so dynamic as an economy is a more flexible labor market with lower levels of government spending. But I do think one of the lessons I take away from the globalization experience is that sort of leaving it to the individual to sort out their lives amid really tumultuous economic change is not going to work. It did not work in the past. And you look to the rise of artificial intelligence, which is likely to be the next great economic shock. And I say in the book, we need to apply the lessons that we learn from the last 30 years. We can't roll the clock back, but we've got to learn some lessons and apply them to what comes next, or we're going to have the same sort of political consequences and unhappiness that we've experienced to date.
Let me respectfully push back just a little here, because in your chapter on COVID, and this is what brought a lot of this to light, and I thought you did just a great job of weaving that in and telling the story. A lot of people woke up to the fact we just don't make a lot of stuff here anymore. A lot of strategic, important things, face masks, for example. And I keep going back, and a lot of people I talk to bring up that, in World War II, it was the arsenal of democracy. We were able to transform our auto plants into making tanks and bombs, etc. And there's a question of whether we could do that today. And the sense is that we've got to start making more stuff here. And I think nobody really realistically thinks we can go back to the big auto plants of the 1950s, but there is a strategic interest in making more things here. And I understand the limits of it, that we're still in a global economy and all, but that I guess that's kind of the counter, I would call argument or whatever, that somehow we got to figure out a way to make more things here. There's a strategic value in that.
No, I don't disagree with that at all. There's two points. I think you've rightly pointed out that the thinking has turned away from optimizing supply chains purely for cost and efficiency. Now the buzzword is resiliency. So if one supplier goes down or political considerations preclude you from buying as much from China, well, you've got a backup supplier. But maybe they're in Mexico, or maybe they're in Illinois. You know, it's not going to be, the Biden administration talked of friendshoring. I think the Trump administration has complicated that a little bit because, the Mexicans and the Canadians were supposed to be our primary friends, and the president has hit both of them with repeated rounds of tariffs. So, if you punch your friend in the face often enough, they may not be your friend in the long term. But the second consideration is, even if we do bring back production of some strategic materials, and I think the Trump administration deserves credit for moving on what's called the rare earth minerals that we are dangerously dependent on China for. And those are used in everything from smartphones to jet fighters, satellites, all sorts of military applications. We literally could not fight a war against China or anybody else without Chinese rare earths. So the Trump administration deserves credit for moving out on that. But even bringing back production of, say, ventilators and face masks and selected other key products, you're not going to get the same employment pop that you would have had 10 or 15 years ago. Those factories are now even more automated today than they were when the work moved offshore.
Well, just to wrap up, we've gone by really fast here, and I've got a lot of other topics, but that's good. We'll leave our audience wishing for more because this book, again, is very, very important for our region, and I think it's very well done. Just if you could, in 60 seconds, I saw several references here in the concluding chapter, your interview with former President Clinton, and then you talked to a Clinton administration official. They seem to talk about that it was a messaging problem, partly. In 60 seconds, do you think this was policy or messaging or just both?
I think it was policy at the end of the day. And I did think it was a fascinating interview. And as you say, it concludes the world's worst bet. It's a separate chapter of my sit down with Bill Clinton. And as always, and he's now in the lion in winter phase of life, but still just as sharp as a tack and really thoughtful in talking about these issues. But at his bottom line, even though he acknowledged when I said, hey, I think the problem is we never kept those promises that we made to people that nobody's going to be left behind. We're going to do what's necessary to make sure we all benefit. We never kept that promise. He said, I agree with that. So he sees what happened. And one of his key aides said, he thinks he, referring to Clinton now, thinks that we should have done both at the same time. If we were going to open up to with NAFTA and to China at the same time, these benefits for workers and help for communities that would be hard hit should have been part of the package. And that, to me, was the only disappointment. That at the end of the day, Clinton's argument for globalization today is the same argument he made 30 years ago, and this is, we've ended up where we've ended up, and this was not the destination we had in mind.
Well, it's an outstanding book, and I'm really thankful that you took the time to come on. And for our listeners, again, very important book, a very even-handed and objective look at this phenomenon of globalization that's impacted our lives so much. David Lynch is the author. He's the global economics correspondent for the Washington Post, and the book is called The World's Worst Bet: How the Globalization Gamble Went Wrong and What Would Make It Right. Hey, still time for a late holiday gift, but this is an important gift for anybody, anytime. David, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you, Robin.
You've been listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. You can follow Heartland Politics at WVIK.org or wherever you subscribe to podcasts.